This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
I know what you're thinking. Mine's bigger than yours, right? Isn't that fair? Throw it away. All right? All right! They're coming! The rats are coming! Thousands of them!
Tell me about Disneyland.
They got tons of popcorn there.
Yeah.
And all you gotta do is go climb a tree to go eat it.
It was a night like any other night. Then something happened.
Oh, good Lord. It's unbelievable. It's horrible.
Hey, wait. There's something weird here.
Welcome to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of low-budget cinema.
The sleep of reason gives birth to monsters.
Hi, my name's Chris, and along with Jeff, we're bringing you the very best and worst of horror, sci-fi, post-apocalyptic wasteland, kung fu, and women in prison movies from the 1960s to today. Check us out at reallyawfulmovies.com, part of the Crypt TV family.
She lives. The other girls are getting obscene phone calls.
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 74B, Black Christmas.
Fa-la-la-la, it's the holiday season. To celebrate, we're going to be talking about one of the most seminal horror movies ever made, Black Christmas, from 1974. This is a movie that basically started it all when it comes to the slasher genre. All the conventions, all the tropes, all the things that we've
come to know and love with the slasher movie genre, whether it's the POV killer, the co-eds stuck in a house who are being picked off one by one, you throw in the threatening phone calls, there's too many to mention.
The phone calls coming from within the house.
Yes, like the urban legend, yes.
Yeah. Now, interesting pedigree about this movie in the sense who directed it, who starred in it. The director was Bob Clark. Bob Clark, it's really funny because when you look at his career, I mean, he made this movie, Black Christmas. He also made the beloved, although I've never actually sat down and watched the entire movie, A Christmas Story.
Oh, okay.
You know, the one with...
I thought you were going to say Porky's.
And Porky's. Oh, yeah, he also made...
If you hadn't sat through the whole thing of that, I would have to say you had your alpha male card rescinded.
But A Christmas Story, I mean, everyone knows that movie with I guess his tongue stuck to the post. And the leg and blah, blah, blah. I went to a Christmas party a couple years ago. It was on in the background. People love that movie. He also made another really cool horror film before this one called Children Shouldn't Play With Dead Things. Really cool movie. The cast of this movie is unbelievable. John Saxon.
Can't go wrong.
You cannot go wrong. Margot Kidder.
Yes.
Who everyone knows, of course, is Lois Lane from Superman. Keir DeLay, who played Peter in 2001. Andrew Martin from SCTV. Some notable Canadian actors, Art Hindle, Lynn Griffin, who was also in Curtains. And I'm saving the best for last because, man, do I love her. Olivia Hussey.
Unfortunate name, but yeah.
It's not even her real name. That's her nom de plume. She actually picked that name.
Wow.
But Olivia Hussey, high school? Come on, man. Zeffirelli? Romeo and Juliet?
Oh my God.
That was her, uh-huh. Man. And, I mean, she played Juliet in Franco Zeffirelli's adaptation of Romeo and Juliet. And
we had so many period pieces foisted on us in high school that it was hard to really differentiate.
Yeah. And after we reread Romeo and Juliet, as they would, you know, after you read Macbeth, we watched the movie Macbeth, etc., they played Zeffirelli's Romeo and Juliet. Now, here I am, I think it was like grade 10, okay? And I'm watching this movie in school, and this movie, and I'm falling in love with this Juliet, this Olivia Hussey, and she did a nude scene at the tender age of 15. She was only 15 years old when she did this nude scene. And at the time I was about 15, so it's appropriate. This is no Jared here, man. I was just like, oh my God, wow, I'm in love with this woman. And, I mean, that was a very auspicious debut to her career. She was in a movie called Turkey Shoot, which I love, directed by Brian Trenchard-Smith, the director of Stunt Rock.
And amazing movie.
So many other incredible exploitation movies. But yeah, Olivia Hussey, she plays Jess in this movie, and she's just one of the girls in my dreams.
For all the directorial credits of Mr. Clark, you omitted my favorite that I've talked about other instances in the podcast, Murder by Decree.
Mm. Which I haven't seen.
Yes, which I have to revisit. This is the movie that gave me the night sweats.
That got you into horror, basically.
Yes,
yeah.
And it's the period piece chronicling the Whitechapel murders.
Starring Christopher Plummer.
Yeah, the Jack the Ripper piece that envisioned Sherlock Holmes investigating the Ripper murders. And that thing scared the living crap out of me and kept me up all night. So this guy, again, all his movies are to certain extent. They're all pretty terrific. He's mm-hmm. a very talented guy. And unfortunately, we lost him a few years back to a car accident. Mm-hmm. But amazing and a pretty visionary character as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you wrote about this movie on our website, you called it the Rocket 88 of horror films.
Yes.
Please explain that reference.
Rocket 88, I guess, I don't want to say widely because I'm sure there's going to be some internet pedant who will say, no, this was, but Rocket 88 was arguably the first rock song ever recorded. Sometime in the 50s, I think it predated Ike and Tina, Elvis, all that kind of thing. And it was...
So not Bo Diddley, not Chuck Berry.
No. And this, you could make the same case that Black Christmas was the first slasher.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's interesting because a lot of people credit John Carpenter's Halloween for being the first slasher. But a lot of the elements that made Halloween so successful were already done 4 years prior in Black Christmas, i.e. the POV shots of the killer.
Yes.
The movie starts with the POV shot of the killer. Also, you know, this was the first movie to set a horror film around a major holiday.
Yes.
So before Halloween, we had Christmas.
Yes, and then it was just followed by just a litany of, mm-hmm. of other ones. My God, My Bloody Valentine, New Year's Evil... Christmas Evil,
April Fool's Day, graduation day.
Yeah.
Even, you know, it's Friday 13th. It's, yeah. You know, so, yeah.
Is there an Independence Day massacre? I don't know.
Well, there's Independence Day, which was sort of a massacre when I saw it in the theater because I really did not like that film.
This is true, yes.
You know, that, although yeah. I love Jeff Goldblum, but Will Smith and, you know, all the other, anyway, whatever. There's no movie about Hump Day. At least not in the non-adult section of the video store. Those still exist.
If memory serves, there is a Bloody Wednesday movie.
Yeah?
I think. Okay. I'll have to look that up.
I just would say, like, if there was a movie called Hump Day, it would probably not be for minors. But anyway, I digress. So.
Well, as we said earlier, a bunch of...
Well, I was going to say, that's a great segue, because speaking of not for minors, let's talk about The Voice on the Phone. So we have a bunch of young, nubile sorority. Well, yeah.
Yeah, so it is a sorority.
Sorority
a co-eds sisters. In a house.
Yeah.
And they have a den mother. I'm not exactly sure what the term is for it now or whether it's extant at all because obviously this was a different time. But they have a woman whose job it is to look after the interests of these young undergraduate students.
And by the way, I hated this character. Her name is Mrs. Mack. This movie is incredible for its influence, but in my opinion, it is flawed. And
for sure,
I really hated Mrs. Mack. I hated this character. But anyway, yes, the den mother, the house steward. I don't know what you want to call it.
Yeah. I guess right now it would be almost the equivalent of a don in a dorm room.
Docent, is that what they call it?
Is that a female don?
I don't know. Maybe.
Who knows? Okay, someone who's in charge.
A Donna.
A Donna. Okay.
I don't know.
A prima donna? I don't know. Either way, yeah, it's an interesting character. So she's supposed to be looking after all these young girls. And she is a bit of a booze hound. And in one great scene, she has a library, because this is a frat house, or a sorority house. It's a giant Victorian-era kind of big home, and she is looking for hooch in the evening to celebrate Christmas cheer in her own inimitable way, and she looks on the shelf, and under B for booze, she pulls out a title, and inside the book is where she's hidden her flask, hidden her liquor. And she's supposed to be in charge of all these,
What I love slash hate it, because it's fucking disgusting. Like, I love my alcohol. You know, we're sipping on a nice Smash Bomb Flying Monkeys Atomic APA right now as we're recording this. Is when she goes into the toilet, not the toilet bowl, but whatever you call that, where, you know, the flushing mechanism is.
Yeah.
And that's where she hit her another, like, you know, Mickey or something. Like, that's disgusting, man. I'm not drinking anything that comes out of a toilet bowl.
Yeah, and odd, considering she would... Well, why wouldn't she just... Again, one of the many flaws in this otherwise a fun movie. Well, if you're the Don, or the person in charge of other people, she surely would have her own room or an office. So why didn't she just stash her hooch there?
And the other thing, too, is that, I mean, nobody in this sorority was what you would call, like, a member of the Upright Citizens Brigade. I mean, everybody, you had Jess, you know, who was pregnant.
Yes.
Engaging in premarital sex.
Yes.
You had Margaret Kidder's character, Barb, who was just completely foul-mouthed, lascivious, etc.
Yes.
So, I mean, Mrs. Mack fit right in. She had no reason to hide her... proclivity for the bevy
for the,
you know, from the rest of the...
this is very true.
So, but you know, I segued into the voice on the phone a way back.
Yes.
So let's go back to that. Because, yes, it's Christmas time, and the phone rings, and there's this sound that comes through the phone, this voice, and it's this weird kind of, like, I don't know, like, almost like white noise static, with this really bizarre kind of, like, quacking voice, which Lucio Fulci also utilized in the New York Ripper,
yes.
Yeah. And they're picking up, hello. And all of a sudden you hear these vile things.
Yes, which was really interesting for the time, as this came out in, what, 73, 74. There's the C word. This is an obscene caller.
Yes, yes. He goes, let me lick your pretty big cunt. And this is like Beavis or Butthead or whatever. suck on my juicy big cock. And then something like, somebody, they mentioned something about his tongue. He goes, I'll stick my tongue up your pretty pussy.
Yeah, like, really, really, really ahead of its time.
Yeah. extremely, extremely...
exploitative,
yeah. Yeah, and it's funny because I haven't seen this movie in about a dozen years, and so I revisited it last night for this podcast, and when he started going into that sort of stuff, I was shocked at the verbiage coming out of this mouth. Amazingly enough, when they shot the film, they actually recorded much more tame dialogue, and that was put in post-production. But anyhow.
Cool. Good call.
So one of the sorority sisters is Lynn Griffin playing Claire. And she goes upstairs, and she is in one of the greatest deaths in horror history.
Yes.
Asphyxiated with a plastic dry cleaning bag. And she is then... It's very... Okay, so here's where some of the flaws come into play, in my opinion. Because, yeah, she's asphyxiated with the bag. She spends the entire movie up in the attic with this bag over her face. I mean, it's a great image. Don't get me wrong.
For sure.
But the thing is that her father was meant to meet her on the campus of the university they were attending, which happens to be the University of Toronto.
Yes, and I gotta say, I texted you while I was watching this, because the dad is coming to visit his daughter at the university, and he picks a random passerby and says, hey...
Well, it wasn't random, he threw a snowball in his face, but anyway.
He happens by and says, hey, do you happen to know... So and so, and the guy says, "Oh yeah, I do. They're a sister sorority. I'm in a frat."
Yeah,
this was shot. This is shot at my alma mater, the University of Toronto.
Yeah,
the biggest university in Canada, has 65,000 students. And although the viewer wouldn't know this, still, if you were to go to any university campus, from the smallest liberal arts college to the largest state university, and go, "Hey, do you know John Smith?" Do I? Yeah, it's as absurd as when you're traveling abroad.
Well, I was going to say,
let's say you're in Japan.
Because we're Canadian,
yes,
right?
And a Japanese person says, hey, you're Canadian. Do you happen to know, Bill Johnson? And, oh yeah, I know him. He's my neighbor.
Yeah.
I was killing myself.
He has
myself
right next to me.
Yeah. Yeah, and then, as you said, this sort of nebbishy dad, who, it should be said, is appalled by the conduct of the people who live in this sorority house.
And Mrs. Mack.
So you've got a drunk who's supposed to be the authority figure, and then you've got the girls in the house who are like girls gone wild who like to party with the best of them. And he cannot find his daughter. And it's, yeah, as you said, it's been a day or two, and no one knows where she is. We know, obviously, she's in the attic.
Asphyxiated.
In a, some sort of rocking chair or whatever the hell it was.
With a feline on her lap. And,
yes.
And that's the thing that I was watching this movie, I was like, I don't get it. Because, this is a large house, okay? Where's Claire? Her father, wants to...
Wants to find her.
And, there's a very ineffectual law enforcement agent by the name of Nash.
Yes.
And, this guy is completely clueless. When they talk, he doesn't give a shit about the obscene phone calls. He doesn't give a shit about the missing Claire. He's like, yeah, whatever. Margaret Kidder has a lot of fun with him in terms of... saying her phone number, calling it fellatio, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, and he misinterprets fellatio as Felicia. But he's basically just a lunk-headed cop, and they bring up their complaints that there are various girls missing in the town, and they actually call him out. I believe one of them says, for a public servant, your attitude sucks, which is just great. So he's this sort of a desk jockey cop who's just fields phone calls, and he basically just passes the buck and does nothing.
Thank God for John Saxon, Lieutenant Kim Fuller, finally...
Thank God for him, and for being such a active participant in Nightmare on Elm Street as well. Like,
that's
finally
true.
A good...
And the dragon and so on and so forth.
Finally,
and
then, a good cop is on the
Who says
on the ball?
Who says Nash? I don't think you can pick your nose without written instructions.
Yes,
but ultimately, Mrs. Nash is supposed to go. Sorry, Mrs. Mack. My mistake. Yeah. Is supposed to go into town and is supposed to be driven by the father of Claire. And as she's getting ready, she gets a hook in her head and she's hoisted up into the attic. She's up there with the late Claire.
With the late Claire, yes.
And not the A Claire, but the late Claire.
Yes.
Anyway. Whatever. But anyway. They form a fucking search party after a number of days to go looking for Claire.
Yes.
They go out into the vast wilderness, the hinterland of Toronto, to find Claire.
Yeah, they, complete with a snowmobile. Like, it doesn't get more Canadian than this.
They do come across a dead child, and they're in the woods and everything.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking in my head, I'm like, a fucking search party? Go upstairs! She's in the attic!
Yeah,
she's starting
even
to decompose, man!
Yeah, this is true.
Smell.
Rigor mortis is setting in,
yes.
But at the very least, and they only got to it later, they could have searched her bedroom to find out where she might have gone, rather than wandering around the wilds of Toronto. But if someone disappears, you go to their place and see if... let's say they've got a diary entry. Let's say they've... Yeah, a bunch of clothes strewn about. Maybe they've been robbed. Maybe they've been kidnapped.
Mm-hmm.
They do not go to her bedroom and trying to figure out where the heck she went to.
And so that was just a little like...
But speaking of snowmobiles, this is great. I felt so Canadian after watching this movie. Not only is this filmed in Toronto, my alma mater, University of Toronto, there's snow all over the place. There's a snowmobile. There's toques.
Mm-hmm.
You name it. There's also a hockey scene with a Friday the 13th mask-wearing character who is the boyfriend of one of the girls in the house.
Of
Claire,
yes. The one that was asphyxiated.
Yes.
And this is Chris, played by Art Hindle. Another, interesting piece of non-Canadiana is that this was a tax shelter film. This was from that era. And what they would do is they would somehow try and make it seem like it took place in America.
Yeah, so you've got to add a Stars and Stripes flag on
yes.
the desk of a cop.
So as far as, despite the fact that this film is as Canadian as can be, when they're talking to John Saxon, Lieutenant Ken Fuller, he's got this little pathetic dollar store American flag on his desk to kind of throw us off the case. Like, this has got to be taken to place some major U.S. metropolis somewhere in it.
Well, and speaking of red herrings, there's also a character, Peter,
mm-hmm.
who is a music student,
mm-hmm.
and he studies at the conservatory, and he's sort of a tortured, temperamental artist. And he is shown in one scene smashing a piano to bits after an audition goes bad.
Yeah,
so
he's like the Glenn Gould of the picture.
Yeah, speaking of Toronto. and he's meant to be the... red herring.
Oh my god, how obvious of a red herring can you get?
He's the guy who destroys the piano with a hammer. He's got to be crazy. He has a weird look. He's got weird, like, Charles Manson hair.
Yep.
And you figure, that guy's got to be the killer.
Yep, this is Cure Delay, and he's also Jess's boyfriend. He's the one that impregnated her. There's a lot of tension between her and Jess because she wants to abort the baby. He doesn't want that to occur.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing about it, and Jess, this is Olivia Hussey, she plays a very pivotal role because she's pretty much the final girl, right?
Mm-hmm.
So as people are getting picked off in the sorority house, and these phone calls continue, and they're just completely obscene and completely
Disgusting,
but not even that, but discombobulating, just the voices coming out. It's Billy, Billy is the one that's making these calls.
And this finally spurs the cops into action to actually go to the sorority house.
And to finally fucking trace the call, and this is one thing I did appreciate, is see Les Carlson, who we know from a ton of Cronenberg films, like Videodrome, Dead Zone, The Fly, working frantically to trace the call. His poor Jess has to keep talking to this guy and running around in what looks like a CERN reactor or something, to trace a bloody phone call is hilarious. But anyhow, and the other thing about Jess that's kind of funny, I don't know if you noticed this, but her sweater that she was wearing to cover her comely body.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of reminded me of the master's robes in Mao's Hands of Fate. There's two hands.
Excellent, yes.
Covering
her ample
testicles.
Bosom,
indeed. So she's left in the sorority house with Phil, played by, this is Andrew Martin's character, and they're so there's a search party going on. Ostensibly, Barb is upstairs asleep, Marv Kidder, but Barb has been another great death, killed by...
A unicorn statue.
A glass unicorn statue.
Yes, one of the great deaths in horror history.
And that was shot really, really well.
It was really cool.
Another amazing shot was Billy's eye. That was an incredibly iconic
shot. It's all
shot.
You really see of the antagonist here.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, everyone is thinking that it's Peter, but at one point Peter's got an alibi, and she's all happy it's not Peter, and they're tracing the call, and blah, 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 blah. And finally find out that the call is
coming from
within the house.
And yeah, baby.
And Nash, the idiot cop, is like, Jess, get out of the house.
Yeah.
But what does she do? She starts calling, Barb, Phil, and she doesn't get out of the house. She runs upstairs again. Like, I couldn't get past this. Even I was watching a documentary afterwards, and the actress of Olivia Hussey said, I would have been out of the house before you even said my name. But no, she runs, she goes upstairs and, you know, wants to confront the maniac that's in the house. The movie basically piles on the red herring of Peter being the killer, and ultimately we're left to surmise that he was a killer. However, there is a twist at the end, which is sort of a
shoehorned-in backstory for the obscene caller. Yeah, it left a few ends
untied.
Mm-hmm. But arguably,
but I mean, it's scary because I mean, you know. He's still out there, and as the camera sort of pans away and during the closing credits, and we see the house, and we see the cop standing in front, you know, the sentinel on guard, what have you.
Yes.
You hear the phone ringing yet again. So, of course, you know, that's cool. I like those ambiguous endings, yes. You know? So we never really know, you know, who the killer is. We never really know what his motivations are. Yes. A lot of flaws, a lot of things that made me just kind of nuts. Because, like I said, I haven't watched this film in a dozen years.
Yeah.
But, at the same token, we have to appreciate this movie because of its tendrils, because of its reach, because of its influence. And there's a lot of other amazing things about this movie. There's the atmosphere, the feeling of dread, you know what I mean? This is a Christmas movie. It takes place during, you know, December, let's say. But it's the total antithesis of festive. You have your wreath on the door. You have your carolers. But
Yes. Yeah, the O Come All Ye Faithful carolers. And there's a wonderful scene, the juxtaposition of the murder and the cut to the kids singing. And something about kids singing in a horror film that's kind of creeps me out. And that was really neat.
Mm-hmm. So, but I don't even know what the character his name was, but at the beginning he's dressed up as Santa Claus, one of the rotund characters with a gigantic, very impressive afro. You have these
and he's not happy to be Kris Kringle.
No, but
he's pissed at his gig and drops F-bombs and says, oh, why am I doing this shit? Yeah, this is not... It's a wonderful life.
No, you have these archetypes of Christmas, but it's not festive.
No.
It feels like the bizarre world of Christmas. Although Christmas is going on, there are no jingle bells. There's nobody saying Merry Christmas. There's no joy. There's nothing. No. It's just there's a real feeling of a choking atmosphere, a feeling of dread, a feeling of almost nihilism in this movie, which I appreciated.
I guess presumably we can only guess that the co-eds could not get home to their families for Christmas, or they were just milling about after classes had come to an end, and they're stuck in this house in the deep, dark winter. And
but it's not even that. I mean, even at the police station, I mean, there's nothing really festive feeling about it, despite the inclusion of the carolers, despite the inclusion of the Christmas decorations, the Santa, whatever. It's a bleak film.
Yeah,
it's
for sure.
It's bleak from frame one to the end. I appreciate the fact that it maintained its bleakness.
For sure.
I appreciate the fact that, as you said before, you know, the whole Rocket 88, I mean, a lot of these elements of the slasher film that were attributed to John Carpenter were actually done 4 years prior by Bob Clark in Black Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
I appreciate the fact that there's some really cool kills, you know? It's not a very high body count movie.
No.
Not a lot of blood, but a lot of this, the fright is in the atmosphere and the very disorienting, disturbing voice of Billy, the caller, who keeps calling and calling and calling, and the things that come out of his mouth, it's just like...
Yet they keep answering the phone.
Well,
She kind of had to in order. We couldn't trace it.
At a certain point, she had to, yeah.
Poor Jess, man. She just wanted,
no gentleman caller there, that's for sure.
Yeah. And then on the other hand, Peter's calling saying, kill the baby, and then Saxon says, what the fuck was that all about? Yeah. There's a lot of things that are going on in this movie that give it a real sort of mounting sense of dread and bleakness, and it has become a bona fide classic.
For sure.
It's a classic. Not many people will
a classic with a caveat.
Yeah.
And I would give it 3.5 on our rating scale because, again, it's established all the tropes that we become used to seeing almost over the years.
Yeah, almost inured to, in the sense, they become cliches, but, I mean, at this point, it was very fresh. For influence, I'm going to give
five.
It's a 5. Yeah. But for an actual movie, I'm going to give it 2.5. Which is, I know. It's almost sacrilegious.
It is a beautiful film. It's beautifully shot, beautiful, rich colors, some good performances, a good crackerjack script, good little cynicism, ahead of its time in terms of the salty language. And I would say more ballsy than Halloween, even the first Halloween. So even just to drop the C word, it's pretty amazing that this film right now would not be shown on network TV. And there's something to be said for that. What did we learn?
Interesting. I learned that if you have Olivia Hussey in a movie, maybe have her take her top off.
Yeah.
I mean, she did when she was 15. Why can't she do it at this point when she was when she was of age?
Yeah.
Maybe then my 2.5 star rating would have gone up to about 3.5.
Yeah.
No, that's being facetious somewhat. Tell me, Chris, what did you learn?
Well, for a creature that has maybe a brain the size of an acorn, one of the stars that we didn't mention of this film has got to be Claude the cat. MacGuffin. This cat, I guess, goes missing at a certain point, and the den mother goes looking for it and starts calling out for Claude, and opens the hatch, climbs the ladder. Claude, calling out for this kitty. The kitty is on the lap of the deceased, and the poor den mom is ratcheted, I believe the term would be, roped to her death, and all for her concern over her pet. That's it. And it's a pretty good performance by Claude.
I will give credit where credit is due. This could have been maybe the first ever cat jump scare, but they did not go that route. So good on them for that,
For sure, for sure.
Because damn, that's one trope. They could have started, they did not. So now,
my second most hated trope, the cat jump scare and the looking into the medicine cabinet and then the mirror fright. And then you look behind you and the thing's not there.
Yeah.
But those are my top two for sure.
I will give credit to this film for never giving us a clear view of the killer.
Just the eyeball.
Just the eyeball and a little silhouette at one point when he's killing Barb.
Yes.
I will give it credit for that ambiguity and so on at the end. But so I'll bump my rating up to a 3.
For sure. Very fair. Without this, you would not have your sorority house massacres. Not that that's the Citizen Kane of slashers. You would not have your Halloweens. You would not have all the others. This is the progenitor. This is something that kind of does us proud as Canadians. It was a little tax shelter movie that could and had some future stars who made it big thereafter. Yeah. And it was a really neat thing.
It was also remade in the, I believe, in the late 90s, early 2000s, a shitty remake, but let's not even go there.
And you have taught at a college where this house is located, and to nerd out for a little bit here, in the winter, when we get our first major snowfall, I'm going to go up to where this house is and take a few photos. And I think I will enjoy that. And this definitely has a place not only among Canadian cinema, but
cinema. Yeah.
And I'm happy to have seen it twice now. And there's something to be said for it. If not being able to give it our wholehearted endorsement, this is.
Let me see. So, are you dreaming of a Black Christmas?
Maybe more of a Black Sunday. Maybe a superior film there, but Black Christmas, really cool film in its own right, worth checking out, and definitely check out our site as well. And we have a really neat list of our top 13 Yuletide Christmas horror favorites. Mm-hmm. So check that out.
Of which this is on. So.
Yes, and we'll be tweeting that out, and you can decide for yourself whether our picks are ones you would have picked. Mm-hmm. www.reallyawfulmovies.com. Be sure and follow us on Twitter, awful_movies. We're part of the Crypt TV family, and we'll talk to you soon.
Take care.